And hello, this is The People's Game. I am Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by...
Pablo Morales.
Pablo is the man behind the movie Gringos at the Gate, a film about the USA-Mexico soccer rivalry that is going to be out soon. We hope to be joined by birthday girl Jennifer Doyle, who is in New York City as she has flown off already to track global soccer and be on assignment for The People's Game following the end of the 2010 World Cup tournament. Later in the hour, we are going to hear from an interview I did with Franklin, segments of an interview I did with Franklin Foyer, and he is the author of the classic work, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. We talked earlier today. I thought it was a fantastic interview, and we'll hear a few excerpts from that. We will then also hear one excerpt from an article with Gabriel Kuhn, who is the author of a book called Soccer and the States, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. And we will also hear about a screening of the film Kicking It, an amazing documentary that chronicles the 2006 Homeless World Cup in Cape Town, South Africa. But the big news, of course, is Spain are the world champions. And right now we are joined. The other big news is it's Jennifer Doyle's birthday, and we're joined by Jennifer Doyle. Welcome to your show, Jennifer.
Hi, Alan.
I explained that you're already off on assignment tracking global football, and your first stop is New York City. And happy birthday, Jennifer.
Thank you. So, I'm enjoying actually feeling like I've been let out of jail. That was an awfully long and intense experience, World Cup, following the World Cup in such detail for a month.
And complimenting it with like doing a daily radio podcast? I'd recommend it to anyone, right?
Yeah, I would. Well, I mean, it makes you watch the game with, a certain kind of attention, more attention than you would normally give to, say, for example, the first 30 matches that most of the world ignored.
By the way, first of all, it's your birthday. Happy birthday. It was my daughter Millie's birthday yesterday. She was 3. You're what, about 27 right now?
Thank you, Alan. We'll just leave it at that as the record,
I wanted to say that, though. I know it's a sly and stilly and stupid and stumbling thing to say, but I wanted to say it because, folks out there, soccer is better for you than Oprah. Because Jennifer's in amazing shape, and she certainly looks 27. So
I'm going to say, Alan is actually referencing we play together, and I'm going to say the same about Alan, who is a fantastic player, and I think we both, our participation in the sport helps nurse our illusions of our youth.
Well, Jennifer, Spain, since I've spoken to you last, has won the world championship. Your thoughts on the match yesterday?
All I have to say is that it's like any other final, be it, your local, men's tournament, or the final of the World Cup. It's, a game of tactics and a game of fouling. I mean, that was the one piece of information that I had, going into it, was I was thinking this is, the result of this match is going to be determined by how Spain reacts to how the aggressive fouling from the Dutch. And lo and behold, that was one of, sadly, sort of the big story. But, it was, I think for a lot of people, it was a game of anti-football. I mean, for me, it was 3 seconds of Spain and an hour and 20 minutes of kind of the perhaps least exciting version of European football. I mean, I think I'm exaggerating slightly, but...
No, not that much, actually. There were headlines.
The third place match was better. I mean, the third place match was more open and more fun and just a much better experience in terms of viewing. Now, of course, I was really happy because I was pulling for Spain, so I did leap off the couch and shout at the top of my lungs when Iniesta scored that marvelous goal. So
yeah, and we've mentioned often on this show that Johan Cruyff was this person, this great Dutch footballer who was in his prime in the mid-1970s, who then went from Ajax in Amsterdam down to Barcelona and brought the Dutch style of play to Barcelona. Well, he finally came, he spoke a little bit in the press in advance of the match, but he had just scathing words today in the media for the Dutch team, which he felt performed disgracefully, and then praise for the Spanish side. And of course, he lives in Barcelona and still is involved with, very much as a manager of the Catalonian national side.
No, he was fired from that position on July 2nd.
Oh, he was?
Yes, he was.
He was fired from it on July 2nd?
Yeah.
Oh, there, that slipped through the cracks.
He no longer has an actual position on within the club.
But he his place within the pantheon of soccer gods has been reconfirmed, even if he's a prickly fellow.
Yeah.
I don't know, Alan. I think that you have this you have a need which I still have yet to understand fully, to imagine that the Dutch won this one way or another.
It's because of David Winter's great book, which we had that interview with him, and I was just mesmerized by that book.
I think the final for myself was just a classic case where one team tries to mimic another team's formula for success. And if you look back at at Spain over the last year and a half, they've only lost two games, the United States and then again Switzerland in the first game of this World Cup for them. And in both those, they clogged the midfield. They fouled heavily in a hope of disrupting the Spanish passing game and actually getting under the skin of the Spaniards. Unfortunately for Holland, they just aren't as good at it as the U.S. and the Swiss were.
And that's a great point, because it was clear from the first 5 minutes that that's what was going on.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate too. And actually, Cruyff mentions it in today's little talk with the press that, you know, he felt that Barcelona had lost in the semifinals of the European Championships to Inter, and Inter had done the exact same thing to Barcelona. When you look at the core group of the midfielders for Spain, they are Barcelona. So, again, they're just trying to mimic a previous team's, you know.
I know that this might get into minutiae that a lot of the listening audience aren't familiar with.
Oh, sorry.
Because we trust.
I got to tell you guys, I'm going to have to peel off. But before I do, I want to encourage listeners to tune into ESPNU and ESPN3 for the Women's Under-20 World Cup. The future of the women's game will be right before your eyes, and we have a wonderful matchup on July, I think that's the 14th, between the USA and Ghana. So we get to sort of wonder how much do those grudge matches actually carry over from the men's game into the women's game.
Well, you can't slip away quite that easily without one more question, Jennifer Doyle. And it's yes, the big question really for this show and this project, which is the people's game. We're here in Southern California, or even take it globally. How is soccer able to be held on to as the people's game, in particular here in Southern California? What's your take on that?
I don't think that the game is at risk of becoming the sort of corporatized sort of middle-class entity that it's becoming in, say, for example, in England. And even there, I think it's a stretch to suggest that somehow that because the premiership has become what it is, that means that grassroots football and the football played in the lower leagues in England is somehow has nothing to do with working class culture. You know, and I think I think the game here is so far from being fully capitalized or capitalizable that my concern is much more how do we support the grassroots game in Los Angeles. I think we need a union of football players in the city, some kind of attempt to organize us across the different regions of the city to advocate for better field access for reasonable costs, just general sort of development of the game so that we can actually see the talent that we have in this region, you know, that those kids get access to appropriate college scholarships, appropriate mentoring and development of their skills. So that's what I would like to see. So I'm not worried about protecting the game from the kind of FIFA, Coca-Cola, Adidas thing. I think that we're so far from that in Los Angeles that what we should be primarily concerned about is supporting the local organizations like Daniel Morales' YES, YESS, Youth Empowerment through School and Scholastics, you know, supporting their access to fields, to conscientious support of the football players in our local communities. That's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, and not just
nothing to do with FIFA.
And not just the youth, also the fact that soccer is one of those great sports that you can play well into your 40s and 50s, and there's so many adults who still want to participate and don't have access to proper facilities and proper organizations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jennifer Doyle, it's been great working with you on this project. Yep. We will continue to work together, and happy birthday.
And have a good trip.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. It's been great. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jennifer Doyle there, and you can check out her fantastic blog, From a Left Wing. Right, From a Left Wing. I almost said Live from a Left Wing. From a Left Wing. It's a fantastic soccer blog, and you can get networked there with an incredible array of intelligent and brilliant other bloggers around the world that Jennifer links to from that site. So, you know, in a moment we're going to play a little clip from the interview with Franklin Foer, because I asked him right off the bat what he thought about the final, so we'll go to that in a second. But I did want to say, because the point I said about, you know, the minutiae, I didn't want to lose people, is that I I actually think Cruyff was way off base with what he was saying about Inter, because yes, Inter did that when they played at Nou Camp against Barcelona in the second leg, but they scored three goals in the San Siro. Nothing like what Haaland produced yesterday. So I really think that, that Cruyff, again, in his splenetic manner, you know, is a little unfair to Mourinho and those guys on Inter.
Oh, I disagree. I think because in club soccer you have a much stronger home field advantage. So in the San Siro you can play more open.
But look, one of the things that Barcelona made a mistake on this past year, and again, sorry if you don't follow club football out there, was the move of Eto'o. And I think Eto'o worked in their system better than the Ibrahimovic did. So everybody so fetishizes Barcelona. And by the way, Franklin Foer, this is an amazing interview that you're about to hear a segment of, and it's a very long interview. It's already up on the People's Game website. I'll give that information after this clip. But, you know, he's a big Barcelona fan, and I actually think if you look at the way that the Barcelona club was run in the last year versus the Spanish national team, especially even given the fact that Torres got injured, they made the right adjustments on the Spanish national side, and I don't actually think Barcelona over the last however many months did, and Inter really was the side that was more together in that. So anyway, that's my take on that. That's club soccer. Let's now go to the first clip of our interview, interview that I did today with Franklin Foer. He is the editor of The New Republic. He had a marvelous blog on the New Republic website that ran the course of the World Cup, and he is the author of the now classic How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Well, how are you doing? That's the first question. Are you experiencing withdrawal?
I've got the shakes. Yeah, I've got the shakes. You know, I've been bedridden. I'm at a loss about what to do with the rest of my life. So I've just decided that I'm going to start gearing up for the next World Cup. I vowed. I got my family on board for doing a massive road trip to Brazil in 2014. So. I have that to look forward to.
Well, we at the People's Game are in dialogue with people who are trying to organize a global, worldwide, one-month holiday in 2014.
Sign me up as I'll add my John Hancock to that petition.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the tournament itself. I thought your posting yesterday in the wake of the final was really on point about Spain winning the tournament. So let's go right to the games on the field. What did you make of the final, and what do you make of Spain as the 2010 World Cup champions?
I didn't love the final. It was choppy. It was a lot of opportunities blown. It never really developed the rhythm that you'd expect, and Spain never really was able to fully engage in their tiki-taka short passing game, which, you know, a lot of people argue that it's boring, but I love it. I mean, I just love watching the skill, the anticipation, the coordination. It's not a muscular game, but it's, you know, I don't know any other way to describe it other than artistry. And so, you know, I wish Spain was able to put together some sort of magisterial performance in the final game that capped off this great run that they've had as a nation in the sport, and they weren't able to do that. But I would argue that their triumph in this tournament was basically a lifetime achievement award for the Spaniards, that over the course of the last couple of years, between the European Championship, between Barcelona's run in club-level soccer, and this tournament, they deserved to triumph. They're the best team in the world. And I hope that they're able to keep everything together and triumph in the European Championship in 2 years. I'm not sure that they're going to be able to hold the team together until 2014. Xavi, who is the integral component in this team, is going to be 34, and he's hinted that he doesn't think he can make it all the way to the next World Cup at the international level. So they deserve it. They've instigated a tactical revolution in the game. They've played beautiful soccer, and I'm happy for them.
That's Franklin Foer, and this interview takes an arc from the, again, just like we sort of do here on this show, from the action on the field. And as, again, the author of How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization, very interesting to talk to Franklin Foer. And as we talked about the relationship of soccer to globalization as the interview took this arc, again, we've had so many different things that people have brought to that kind of question. And yet here's a guy, again, who even brought new things that hadn't been brought out elsewhere. So I really encourage people to check that out. And they can get the entire interview. It is already up at www.thepeoplesgame.com. franklinfoer.org, and you'll see there Franklin Foer interview, and you can listen to the whole thing. But do that after this hour, by the way, or do that after you're done listening to other KPFK radio across the entire day. What do you make of it? Because that was my sense, too, is that this is ultimately, on balance, Spain were the most positive and best team of the tournament, which is a paradox because they scored freaking 8 goals in 7 games. You know?
Well, goals alone do not dictate how well a team plays. You know, I think that their style is such that they don't create a ton of chances if the other team decides to play a really defensive shell because they want to control the ball in the other third and not just, you know, most teams, they use the medium range passes and then they get the ball into the final third and then the forwards are expected to dribble and shoot. Mm-hmm. And that's all they are. In the Barcelona / Spain creative style is to actually keep the ball moving, one touch, two touch passing, try to create an imbalance in the defensive line, and that is not easy to do. When it's done well, it's beautiful. Since the Spanish forwards outside of David Villa didn't really show up, it's harder to have a high scoring game. It makes a lot of sense that they only got one or two, at the most 2 goals a game, but their defense was very solid, and that's what carried them all the way through.
Yeah, one of the things we speak about in the interview too is what struck me we're going to hear it actually with Foer. It's the next clip we have from the Foer interview. But I mean, you know, this mattered so much to the players by the time you get deep into the tournament that I think that sort of was an element that defined the way that it got so tight. So actually, why don't we play the next clip we have from the interview I did with Franklin Foer? This is the last clip we'll hear this hour. And in this, we go from talking about the World Cup and what it means to the players versus club soccer into the general ideas of his book, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Again, related to your theory in How Soccer Explains the World, what strikes me at the end of the World Cup is now we're 2 decades in from the creation of the Premiership, the Sky Satellite Sports, the Berlusconi Satellite TV, this sort of explosion of club soccer being available for consumption all around the world, followed so closely all around the world. But it strikes me that the World Cup, a combination of the heart that the players put into it, the attention that people around the world give it, still far exceeding the attention given to club soccer, plus national pride, that trumps money. It doesn't matter that these guys are basically being paid sort of a set wage that is nothing compared to what they're paid for their club sides. This is more important. They're going to put their soul, their bodies right on the line for this tournament in ways that you just don't see. I mean, you see it in the club soccer, but not at this level of passion. So I think that's an interesting thing about where soccer...
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what's your reflection on that?
Absolutely, and it's something I find heartening that there are values and commitments that trump paychecks, and that really just knowing how much your countrymen care about the outcome of this tournament is part of the reason that players play so hard and will do everything that they can to win it. And I think it is, in a way, the single most globalized event in all of human existence, yet that it doesn't have, and let's not be naive. I mean, money is a huge part of the tournament and the spectacle, but I think at the end of the day, players aren't motivated by money. And so to have that at the core of this fundamentally globalized experience is something that I find pretty heartening.
For those who've been listening to the People's Game radio show and following the sort of line that we've taken on soccer, its relationship to global culture, the sort of point we are at in human history, as it were, you can only imagine that the book, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization, is something that all of us who've participated in this show have sort of seen ourselves as building upon. But for those people who are unfamiliar with the central thesis of the book, Franklin Foer, your book from, I believe, 2004 was originally published, can you explain how you use soccer as a framing to explain and shed illumination on globalization?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the backstory to the book is that I was a fan of the game, and I'm also a political journalist. And so as I was experiencing the game of soccer, and as there was this tremendous infusion of soccer into American media starting in the mid 1990s, it was actually happened to coincide with this period where people started to talk a great deal about globalization. And so, in my mind, my experience as being a soccer fan was always very interconnected with thinking about globalization. And it was in part because I was experiencing it as a fan, where we suddenly had Rupert Murdoch's Fox Soccer Channel making it possible for us to, or it was called Fox Sports World back then, making it possible for us as fans to watch the English Premier League in Serie A and La Liga on a regular basis. And then you had the internet, which made it so much easier to follow the game. And it just felt to me like my experience as a fan was a pretty good case study in globalization. And then everything that I was seeing on the field was basically just a very clear object lesson in globalization, that you had the global soccer economy booming, and you had players from Africa and South America rushing into the European leagues in great numbers, and you had teams that had tremendous aspirations to become kind of the Walmarts and McDonald's of global soccer. And so the question was, when you had all this change happening, how would that affect the way that people thought about themselves? And I don't think that there's any better proxy for identity than soccer and our teams and the way that we think about our teams. And I think that into my book, I spent about 8 months traveling around the world and trying to collect stories that and tell stories that helped answer this question about how we think about ourselves in a globalized world. And I think that this World Cup shed some pretty interesting case studies of its own onto that question about how we think about ourselves in the global age. And a lot of them are much more encouraging than I would have imagined. And you look at the German team and the way that Germany was able to get behind an incredibly multicultural team with very little rancor back home. That was something that, to be honest, completely surprised me. Or you look at, this World Cup is filled with political storylines, the way in which the French national team imploded. And you do see some of that racial backlash against the multicultural French team. Or the way in which you have Nigeria trying to wrestle with the fact that its soccer federation is thoroughly corrupt and relies on European coaches to come in at the last minute as a crutch to try to keep everything together, is its own interesting little case study. It's one of these books where you wish you could just do a new version of it every couple of years, because it's an ever-changing subject and just incredibly rich.
That is from the interview we did on the People's Game with Franklin Foer. He is the editor of the New Republic and the author of the book How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. His answers as the interview moves forward, his reflections on why the American right wing is fearful of soccer, and also about what it just says about the world that this is the most popular cultural event in the world as we are right now in 2010, in the reality we're all living in. It's a fascinating interview, and I recommend people listen to it. It's on thepeoplesgame.org. Your thoughts, Pablo?
Well, I think it's something that is still part of the learning curve of most the average American sporting fan, and just maybe your average American. I mean, at the viewing party I was at, I'd say half of the people there had never even watched a complete soccer game. They were there for the event. And when it was explained that at that very moment, it's likely that one out of every four people living currently was watching this one event, that there would be nothing else that compares to it in their lifetime watching a final, they suddenly became more interested. They wanted to know more about these players. They wanted to know about more of the style. It's sort of like, and I think also, if I can just stick one step back and say, why is it that these finals aren't always that beautiful, is the players are very much aware that this is a moment of immortality for them. What they do on this field in those 90 or plus minutes will be remembered forever and written about many times, and that video will be shown many times. And it's sometimes they talk about these great players who play for great clubs who in some way get out of playing for their national team or who defer playing for the national team. You know, they aren't going to get a lot of money, and it's very rarely a positive. To be on a losing team is not good for their image, whereas they're going to make plenty of money endorsing their footwear for a Nike or Adidas, and they don't have to go through the hassles of a national team. Let's think of all the French players, for example. That was not good for their image, not mm-hmm. one of them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, how much will Ian Robin be, you know, I'm not quite sure. He's a quirky guy with an interesting character. Not sure how much he will or will not be tormented by the missed breakaway in particular. Mm-hmm. And perhaps then the fact that he just didn't go down. He goes down so easy. And the one time he didn't go down.
I can't believe that.
Yeah, he would have changed the match because Puyol would have been definitely red carded had he just gone back, as he was tugging at him from behind. So, that's Franklin Foyer, the interview we heard, How Soccer Explains the World. Again, you can hear the whole interview on www.thepeoplesgame.org. Right now, I want to move on to the other interview that will be posted soon on that website, but is not up. And this takes us even further into the realm of radical politics and soccer. This is a little clip from an interview you did with a guy named Gabriel Kuhn. And he is the author of Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. We spoke to him earlier today as well, our interview with Gabriel Kuhn. I'm speaking with Gabriel Kuhn. He's the author of a book soon to be released by PM Press called Soccer Versus the State, Tackling Football and Radical Politics. So let's go straight on to the points of view and arguments that you put forward in this book. It says here that soccer, and this is clearly true, is turned into a multi-billion dollar industry. Professionalism and commercialization dominate its global image. Yet the game retains a rebellious side, maybe more so than any other sport co-opted by moneymakers and corrupt politicians. That final point, please explain how you see that, because this has been a big theme that we've spoken about here. In many respects, a lot of our focus has revolved around how soccer, football exists in Southern California and in the United States. But from the perspective of someone in Europe, explain your point.
The point is, I think, that traditionally, and this is difficult, I'm tempted to say, you know, traditionally soccer has been a working class game. That is partly true, and it's partly not true. It's not so much true in the sense that if you look at even the beginnings of soccer in Europe, very soon there were, interests involved that didn't have anything to do with the working class, but with factory owners and others. But it was largely played by the working class, and also the audience has largely been working class. In that sense, I think, you know, that term, the people's game, relates to that. One aspect, of course, is that, you know, it's very easy to play soccer. You need a ball of sorts, and you can play it wherever. I mean, it's nice if you have, you know, a good pitch, but you can play it on the street or whatnot. So soccer has always been played on all sorts of levels, and that certainly continues. So I think what today is interesting and what I'm looking at is that A, there really is some kind of what you might want to call a soccer underground culture, mm-hmm. where people, apart from the professional and commercialized game, organize their own tournaments, have their own clubs, you know, have networks. I mean, there are radical football teams traveling the world today because of those networks, and, you know, play games in Palestine and Chiapas and other regions. So that is one phenomenon that I'm looking at. And the other one is that's a factor in the book. Unfortunately, it's not a strong factor within the professional and commercial game, but it is a factor that remains because you have such a huge audience for soccer, obviously, and so many people are interested in it. It provides a platform where, you know, you can, you know, voice critical or draw attention to certain issues and voice critical opinions on certain, you know, political themes and questions that are being discussed. Now, admittedly, that doesn't happen all that much, but it happens there and there. So that's the other aspect of the book I'm looking at. It's basically, if you're already interested in the professional game, and there's lots of reasons why someone who would, you know, who likes soccer would be interested in it, how can you, where are those kind of radical, critical, progressive elements that you can relate to as a, you know, critical, progressive, radical soccer fan? So they're basically, I'm trying to cover those two aspects, the underground soccer culture, if you will, and the progressive reticle elements within the professional game, which I think both tie back to this tradition of, if you will, the people's game.
I love the way he ends that with the people's game. Yes. So we are listening to the people's game, KPFK Radio's coverage of the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament. This is our final episode of this series, as, of course, the 2010 World Cup tournament has ended. You know, maybe we'll pop in occasionally with special podcasts or special shows when events happen around Southern California that tie in to the sport and the Pacifica mission. Soccer Versus the State is the book that Gabriel Kuhn has written. Tackling Football and Radical Politics is the subtitle of it. That's who you just heard from. The book will be out shortly from PM Press. And that interview with Gabriel Kuhn, I will probably post in its entirety tomorrow at thepeoplesgame.org. Now, the next thing we're going to hear is about a documentary called Kicking It that is playing here in Southern California. I thought this segues very nicely from the clip that we heard from Gabriel Kuhn, because he's talking about, again, this sort of underground world of soccer that exists, especially among political progressives and people who want a socially just society. Well, now we're going to hear from Gerardo Gomez about this documentary, Kicking It, that is playing on Tuesday here in Los Angeles. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Gerardo Gomez. And Gerardo is going to tell us about a screening of the film Kicking It, a documentary that chronicles the 2006 Homeless World Cup in Cape Town, South Africa. It's playing tomorrow night, Tuesday night, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Boyle Heights Tech Center, 1600 East 4th Street in Los Angeles. Gerardo, tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, the film is basically, it just gives people the idea of like what the Homeless World Cup's about. The Homeless World Cup, it's a movement. It's using soccer to bring awareness about homelessness issues. And since soccer is a global international sport, homelessness is a global epidemic, basically. And so the idea is to have people be aware about this issue, but using sports. And I've always felt that sports and the performing arts are great vehicles to bring awareness about social injustices. And so basically, we're showing the film. The film is basically, it chronicles the story of seven individuals, folks from Russia, Afghanistan, Ireland, the States, and Spain. And it's seen, like what they go through, and then people will see them getting to the World Cup. This is it was filmed in Cape Town, South Africa. So the film is basically about the 2006 Homeless World Cup. And it's basically, it's a good film, a good documentary, and I think people will have a different perception on homelessness, on homeless people. So it's a fundraiser for the homeless youth team that represents the Team Los Angeles at the annual Street Soccer USA Cup, which will take place later in the month in Washington, D.C. And basically, it's a fundraiser to kind of raise money for to pay the airfare tickets for these youth. And once at the annual Street Soccer USA Cup, we'll have they'll select an All-Star team to represent Team USA. And this year's Homeless World Cup will be in Brazil in September.
That's so interesting that it follows ahead of where the next World Cup will be. That's very interesting. So it sounds like an amazing film. It's called Kicking It. It's a documentary that chronicles the 2006 Homeless World Cup in Cape Town, South Africa. And it's showing tomorrow night, Tuesday, July 13th, at 7 p.m. at the Boyle Heights Tech Center at 1600 East 4th Street in Los Angeles. So again, that's 7 p.m. tomorrow night. The film Kicking It is screening at the Boyle Heights Tech Center, 1600 East 4th Street in Los Angeles. Gerardo Gomez, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is Alan Minsky, KPFK Interim Program Director, and I'm here with
Pablo Morales.
And I understand that at the end of the screening of Kicking It, there's going to be an open discussion about the film and about, of course, homelessness. That is, again, tomorrow night at the Boyle Heights Tech Center. So I do want to ask Pablo about his film, because we've mentioned it so often just to say that it exists. And I've seen part of it, and I thought it was marvelous. And Gringos at the Gate, tell people out there a little bit more about it.
All right. Just before I do, I just want to encourage everyone to get out to see Kicking It if they haven't seen it. It's one of the best films ever about how the sport of soccer can affect people's lives. And the homelessness issue is global, not just in L.A.
Right.
as we sometimes forget. My film, Gringos at the Gate, is basically a story about how since the late 80s, the United States has started taking the sport of soccer and football more seriously, and how the one country that is most affected by this increase in participation of the sport is Mexico. And we look back all the way to the 50s. We interview one of the original captains of the U.S. soccer team from that era, who talks about how these were all semi-professional players. They would get together the day before a game. They would play in Mexico City in front of 80,000. And they were basically swept aside. And now, all these years later, the United States actually is more than competitive against Mexico. They have actually a winning record against them at home and on neutral sites. And how that is driving the average Mexican fan crazy, because this was their sport, and the United States, they feel, don't take the game seriously enough. They're not passionate enough to be a world leader in the sport. And it's just one more thing that the United States kind of has over them. And that's the crux of the piece.
And, you know, it's funny, though, because, you know, the two teams are isolated. They've moved into sort of the middle range of international sides. Some are between, you know, 8th or 9th in the world and 20th or something, maybe 24th in the world, into that range. And yet they don't have any other regional rivals to sort of help them build their game up. You know, they're almost guaranteed qualification from CONCACAF.
Well, I think what it is that before the United States actually started being more competitive, Mexico was definitely, you could say, a regional leader without competition. And that meant that they were very complacent and weren't trying necessarily to improve their national side. Now that the United States is there, I think there's a possibility that one or both of them will be able to move into the next tier.
Right.
I don't think that was a possibility before.
Right.
And one of the questions I like to ask a lot of the people we interview is, who do you think will win a World Cup first, United States or Mexico? And what's fascinating to me is how many Mexican former players especially kind of have to take a moment to think about that. It's not a knee-jerk, oh, Mexico, although that usually is their answer. It's this, you know, as one Ricardo Paleas, a famous forward for Mexico in the 80s, said, you know, once the United States grabs onto something, they tend to hold onto it till they dominate it. And that was his way of saying, you know, inevitably, probably the United States will be able to do this if they continue to put money in, I mean, resources, and they definitely have the pool of players to pull from.
You know, as I hear you talking again, I hear the interview ringing in my ears from Franklin Foer. He gave a very fascinating response to my query about Glenn Beck and why they hate this as much as they do. I thought that was, again, I really enjoyed that interview with Franklin Foer, which you can find on thepeoplesgame.org. And right now we are joined by Nick Green, who has a fantastic blog called 100% Soccer. I encourage people to check it out as we move away from the World Cup, because it is not only a fantastic blog about global soccer, it's an incredible blog about soccer right here in Southern California. Nick Green, welcome back to The People's Game.
Always a pleasure, Alan.
And we only have a few minutes left, and this is our last 10 minutes on air here in The People's Game here on KPFK Radio. But first off, let's go back to this tournament. Your reflections in a couple minutes on Spain as the champions and on the 2010 World Cup in general.
Spain, well-deserved as champions, I guess. The only nation ever to lose its first game and then go on to win the World Cup, which, to me, pretty much summed up the excitement about this tournament. And I'm sitting here writing my column and pointing out just this sort of thing, this great parity. You know, Spain lost to Switzerland in its opening game. The Swiss lost to Chile. Chile were defeated by Brazil, who were knocked out by the Dutch, who lost to Spain. And then we went on and on like that, you know. Paraguay, Ghana, Uruguay all had great moments. Even countries you don't really think about. Greece, Slovenia, Serbia, New Zealand, Japan, they all made World Cup history for those respective nations with, you know, modest accomplishments. You know, they got their first win or their first point or their first goal. I mean, that was great stuff to see. It wasn't a tournament that was dominated by any one player or any one team and it wasn't a very cynical tournament either. There was a real, I know the final game was ugly, although veteran soccer observers I know kind of really got addicted to the sort of cat and mouse nature of the game between two very technically accomplished adversaries. But generally speaking, this was just a great World Cup from the standpoint of best fan interest we've ever seen in this country, team parity, players who you didn't think would emerge who did, players who you thought would be there who weren't. It was just really, really entertaining.
And Pablo and Nick, what do you guys think about Diego Forlán of Uruguay getting the honor of the player of the tournament as the player of the tournament?
Very deserved, in my opinion. I feel like no other player was more instrumental to their team's success. I think, actually, believe it or not, in a sport where stats don't generally mean a lot, I think his goals and assists, which were the determining factor in him getting the golden ball, actually did point out just how effective he was.
Nick?
Agree with Pablo on every single point. There was no other player who was as important for their respective team as Forlán. He was just, furthermore, he was a joy to watch.
Yes.
When he was in full flight on that ball running at defenders, I mean, it was just great to see. And I thought he thoroughly deserved winning the sort of MVP of the tournament over a bunch of players who, even the day before, you know, in the final, could have stepped forward and taken that honor, and yet didn't, like he did.
And if Uruguay had only gotten the second or third goalkeeper from Spain somehow, I think they would have gotten. They would have beat Germany in that.
Well,
third
they certainly messed up the third place game that guy did. He was definitely serviceable until that pointer.
Yeah.
I do want to mention that across one of the things that we set out as a goal for the tournament is to have correspondence from all 32 nations. We completed that, and I just think of that again as Lazar Trishan was our Uruguayan correspondent, and we had him on. When I first spoke to him, you know, you wonder, is this guy only going to be on once? Well, of course, we ended up having they went deep in the tournament. We were wise to have Tony Presido for Spain. We knew we needed a good Spanish correspondent because they were going to go deep. And we had the best of the possible Dutch correspondents in David Winter, author of Brilliant Orange, the neurotic genius of Dutch football. Well, Nick Green, that's the 2010 World Cup. Now here we are in Southern California, and I was interested in both your and Pablo's reflections on your sense of where the game is in Southern California right now.
Good question. The soccer pundits always like to talk about just what the effect will be of a World Cup, especially one like this one that saw unprecedented media coverage and excellent media coverage, by the way, for a change. I usually like to criticize ESPN, but they were pretty wonderful, I thought, in most respects this time around. And we saw more fan interest than ever before. As a big fan of Major League Soccer, I just hope and pray that people will take the time to check out their own, sadly, often ignored domestic league. I'm not sure that really the World Cup will translate into any sort of soccer is here kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way it will go. It'll be a lot more gradual than that. I do think there's things coming up here in Southern California, not just the under 20 Women's World Cup, as Jennifer likes to point out, that could hold people's interest, that could be somewhat comparable to what we've seen. I was really saddened on Saturday after that fantastic third place game that I thought was possibly the best of the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing two absolutely abysmal MLS games, that Chivas and the Galaxy played against appalling opposition, and it was just terrible spectacles. And I just kept thinking to myself, if anybody was, you know, testing out MLS and checking it out after the World Cup, they would be sorely, sorely disappointed, because I know I was.
Yeah, I have to say that first game that the Galaxy had at home right afterwards against Seattle was a beautiful game to watch. And, unfortunately, you're right. This last weekend was not the showcase. I'd like to think that it's because Donovan wasn't in it, but.
Well,
I think one of the tests will be, apparently there's rumors that ESPN is considering devoting a station entirely to football, is going to try to steal Rupert Murdoch's thunder. Apparently the, Nielsen ratings for, Fox Soccer Channel have risen exponentially. So I think once the global football club soccer kicks in, at the end of the summer, it'll be interesting to see what the ratings are in the United States. I imagine that will be much higher following the World Cup.
I think I may have said this already on the show before, but in terms of people trying to waking up the next day and thinking, wow, you know, has soccer arrived? I think the answer for myself has always been, well, soccer has always been here. It's whether or not the mainstream media decides to focus on it as much as they do for those 4 weeks every 4 years. And I think there is, again, I may have mentioned this as well, there's a wonderful blogger called Du Nord out of Minnesota, and right. He once wrote this, what I think best epitomizes the state of soccer in the United States, and that is that often you look around, you say, God, there's nothing really going on. But then you suddenly step back and you see that you're actually standing on a glacier, and it's been just growing and growing and growing, and it's massive. And that to me is soccer in the United States. It's massive. It's moving mountains, but it's just not, you know, just wham, bam, 4 weeks in July and August, every 4 years. It's much more than that.
Nick Green, a final thought?
If you want to get your soccer fix, if you're going through withdrawals, I've got a couple of ideas. Real Madrid will be coming to the Rose Bowl to play the Galaxy. And Real Madrid, as you know, has many of, well, not as many as Barcelona, I guess, but has some of Spain's World Cup stars. And surely will be worth checking out. And for those who really enjoyed the cosmopolitan world nature of this game, and I'm assuming many of your listeners did, I recommend a movie that I saw during the tournament. It's called Pelada.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's an independent film about a couple of kids, essentially, who travel the world playing pickup soccer games. And if you want something to communicate the simple joy of the game and the universality of the game on a global scale, you couldn't do any better than spending an enjoyable 90 minutes or so with that sweet little movie.
Yeah, we had Gwen and Luke on the show earlier. They're fabulous. It's a great film.
Absolutely.
Well, Nick Green, the blog is 100% soccer. I really encourage people to check it out. It's a great way to stay in touch with soccer, that is football, here in Southern California. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure working with you over this past month.
And thank you, Alan. I think your perspective has really been invaluable during this tournament. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Nick Green. And my final thought simply is that, you know, you look out at the world right now in 2010. The 2010 World Cup soccer tournament is over. It was the most popular. Somebody just wrote here, now let's have some talk about LeBron. No friggin' way, except there was a joke that LeBron is now going to play the Spanish national team. I really think you look out at the world, it's the most popular spectacle in the world. It's where humanity is, and I think on this show we've tried to look at this text, as it were, to get a really deep understanding of where the world is, where globalization is, where people's imaginations are, where people's joy is. And then as someone who's very committed to an idea of social justice and political progressive politics, I think it's important for all of us who see ourselves as wanting a better world to engage with where people are and to see that this was a great coming together of people from around the world. And Pablo, your final thought.
Well, no, I think that people who are very deep into politics don't often recognize the importance of sport in people's everyday lives. It's an offshoot of the Industrial Revolution, and it's important.
Well, thank you so much. I want to quickly thank everybody involved in this project, producer Fernando Romero, Jennifer Doyle, Pablo Morales, Tony Presido, Nick Green. Am I forgetting anybody off the top right now? I think that's it. Thank you so much to everybody out there listening. This has been the People's Game, Pacifica Radio, and KPFK's coverage of the 2010 World Cup Soccer Tournament. I'm Alan Minsky. Everyone's feeling pretty.